first year we broke $1 million in sales a few years ago, I was like, that's great, what a milestone. And then I looked at the P&L and it was like, we made $5,000. The important thing to remember is like inflation doesn't usually go in reverse. You know, once the prices go up, even if the input costs for the guy selling you stuff went back down, like they're going to leave their price alone, right? I mean, that's just how it works. After that first full year of crazy inflation, where they said it was 9% or whatever, for us, it was more. You may see 9% across the board, but for certain businesses, it was a lot more, right? Our packaging cost, our feed cost, our processing cost. Obviously, fuel was bonkers for a while. We went from spending $3,500 a month on fuel to spending $6,000, $7,000 a month on fuel. The answer to improving the system isn't to eliminate the existing system. It's to get...
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
I feel like we already recorded a mini podcast with Parker out there.
I was, part of me was like, well, this is like, we're going to end up repeating stuff if we talk too much now out there. So.
Well, he's one of your biggest fans. I don't know if it came off there, but.
No. We're just glad anybody likes anything that we do. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a big fan as well. So sitting down with Sam Moffitt, owns Shirt Tail Creek Farms, co-founder of Local Pastures, and I won't do the description because these are your companies, but let's start with Shirt Tail, why you started it, what you guys produce, and then how that led to Local Pastures, which is becoming a staple for many people in Austin who care about the quality of their food and accessibility to quality food.
So, yeah, my wife and I started Shirt Tail Creek Farm in 2017. So I had a digital advertising business in Austin, lived in central Austin near UT in a great neighborhood, and had kind of been on a trajectory towards sort of, I don't know, I guess creating this the picture of a life that everybody thinks they want, and things were going good. And my wife and I found ourselves with two little kids in central Austin, successful business, we just weren't fulfilled by our path in life, you know, and kind of looking ahead about, you know, how are you going to feel about this down the road if you just kind of stick with what you're doing, because it was safe, right? I mean, we knew what we were doing, we had a business, but we chose to buy a farm, and we had no intention of starting a farm business at that point in time, because my business allowed me, we had a WeWork office in New York, and I had a development office in Iaj in Romania. And then we had Austin, and, you know, I didn't have to be there all the time. It was digital advertising. I work off my laptop. And so we were just going to raise our kids on this farm and send them to school in the town of Brenham. And, that was that. And just in a nutshell, the business was basically, we were aggregating ad inventory on mobile apps and websites, and by placing our video player on those apps and websites and then selling ads into the video player. It was an arbitrage model. I won't go too deep into this, but basically, you know, that model, browsers like Firefox and Chrome started making those players not function anymore because they didn't like them. And so our business quickly, very abruptly got, you know, turned upside down. And so we were at that point just kind of doing some ad brokering, which was lower margin and higher risk AR. And so I needed to figure out something else to do. I either needed to reinvent that business, which I really had no true passion for, or I needed to just start something else. And I'd really, after 15 years in advertising and 13 years in digital advertising, I had like this strong desire to like be able to hold my creation in my hand and have it be tangible and something that had an artisanal element to it that I could be proud of, that I created. And I at the time I was like really like into single malt whiskey. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I had a copper pot still. And I before we bought the farm, I was in my garage on weekends making whiskey. And I thought, well, maybe I'll start a distillery. We bought the farm, it had a big metal building on it. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do a whiskey distillery, you know, and Texas single malt whiskey and all this stuff. And I kind of put those numbers together and I was like, yeah, that's cool. But you know, to age the whiskey and stuff, it's going to be a while before I generate income, let alone a profit. And I don't know anything about whiskey really beyond what I've learned in the garage. And I started learning about these farms that direct marketed their products and sold, you know, meat and eggs and produce and things like that. And I became really interested in this concept. And so I started researching other farms in Texas that did this. And a lot, you know, a lot of them have YouTube content or whatever. And so I was like YouTube stalking these guys and checking out their websites and buying from the farms. And I was like, wow, this seems like these guys actually have like, are making a living doing this. That's fascinating. You know, I just bought a farm. And my business is going to shit. And so I got to figure out a plan B. And like, this just feels like something I can get passionate about. And it checks the box of me being able to produce a product that's like truly adding value to the customer. Whereas, you know, sometimes when you sell video ads on a mobile app or website, like they may or may not even be seen. And it's kind of a grimy business in certain ways. And so I just felt like a refreshing departure from that world. And so, you know, as I do, I got really fired up. My wife's like, she's the sort of balance in our relationship, and that she'll kind of put me in check if I'm getting too excited about something that's, you know, scares her or whatever. But yeah, so there was already a guy leasing the pasture and had cattle. And so I bought the cattle from him. And didn't know anything about raising, you know, cattle. I had an old guy down the road, a great friend of mine now, who just decided to mentor me. And so I spent, you know, a year or two just helping him with his cattle. And while I was kind of learning my own, how to deal with my own herd, and I had guidance there, you know, which is so important to get into something that's brand new like this to you. And then I heard about a farm out in Elgin, Coyote Creek Farm, and they're a feed mill, but they also have world's best eggs, which you can get at Whole Foods and stuff. And they're great people. And I went to visit them once and I saw how they had pasture raised hens and they had these houses and the rotations. And I thought, wow, well, that's cool. Like, there's a business. Like, I don't have enough acreage to run a massive cow calf beef operation, but like I could run a layer operation and have a few thousand hens and, you know, perform that in a spreadsheet and figure out what that looks like. And it's like, okay, that could pay the bills. Like I could, you know, pay the mortgage and buy groceries doing that. And so I, you know, bought a few hundred hens and the rest is history, and gave my wife lots of little anxiety attacks along the way. Hey, guess what? But yeah, that's kind of how ShureTail happened. And I was searching for something to be passionate about and to jump headfirst into, and that I felt was more meaningful than what I've been doing. And I didn't know it was going to be farming, even though I'd bought a farm to live on and live in the country. I had no sense for what the hell I was, you know, going to do with that place. And it just so happened that, you know, its highest and best use is probably what we're doing now.
Yeah. And it's, again, the eggs that you produce are the best eggs I've ever come into contact with in my 33 years being on this planet. And it's interesting. So you found something that's tangible, you can hold, you can be passionate about. But the other thing that really flows through everything you do at ShureTail and local pastures is the quality of the food. Is that something you discovered along the way as you're figuring out how to go farming? So it's like, all right, I can actually do something with this farm. And then you get further down the road of, all right, let's actually produce good quality, nutritious food.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about farming is it's like a heavily nuanced thing, right? Mm-hmm. You can read as many books as you want, but there's variability in weather, in disease, pathogens that can impact your livestock, or pests that can impact your forages that you use to feed your livestock, and all these sorts of things. And so it's really hard to just learn it from a book. You have to get out and start doing it. And if you get out and start doing it with mentorship like I had, and that's all you're doing, then you can come a long way in a short period of time. But we did learn some hard lessons. I mean, our first group of calves, we had 24 cows and happened to have 24 calves on the ground that first year. And so we put them into our finishing program, which we didn't yet understand really what that was. Because, you know, you think about grass-fed beef and you're like, okay, they just eat grass. Cool. If there's grass, they eat it. Well, you know, what we realize is that the nutritional requirement of a growing calf is very different than the nutritional requirement of a mature cow. And so, like, not all grass is created equal. Not all grass has the same protein content and sugar content, et cetera. And so our first calves, we processed at like 14 months old, and they were fine, but the meat was really lean and the ribeyes were really tough. And, you know, looking back, I cringe, you know, but I had good friends that were like, they were like, showed up to support us in the beginning and bought some ribeyes. And they were like, hey, that ribeye was not so great. So then I became a kind of a student of like how to actually do it well. And I had to fast track that because I didn't want that to happen again. And so, I learned from people like Alan Nation, who've written great books on how to grass finish cattle. And like how to actually meet a cow's nutritional requirements without using processed and grain-based inputs, and to try to overcome the fact that it's just expensive to grass finish beef cattle. But yes, I mean, going into like what I told you about wanting to be proud of this product I had created, in order to do that, I had to become a student of like not only, you know, how to just take care of cattle, but how to produce grasses that they can eat and thrive on, and how to manage the pasture and, you know, all that.
What are the different grasses that you have to?
Oh, well, I mean, seasonally they're different. So we have perennial grasses, which their root systems stay in the ground and they come back year after year. And most of them are exotic non-native grasses that were introduced by people that thought they were solving, you know, forage problems. Because a lot of the native prairie grasses are low nutritional density, what the buffalo would have eaten high volumes of. And so a lot of these exotic grasses have kind of taken over the native grasses, and native grass populations are not great in most pastures. There are a few good meadows that still have predominantly blue stem grasses and stuff. But so those are not reliable for us because they don't have the yield or the nutritional quality that's ideal for us. And so we plant annual grasses every year, twice a year. So for the cool season, we plant a mixture of oats and then legumes like clovers and hairy vetch we like. Legumes pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil so that the grasses can access it and use that nitrogen. So that's what, you know, big conventional farms are doing by throwing synthetic nitrogen fertilizer on the pasture. And then, you know, we plant root vegetables and things. In regenerative farming, which is what we do, you want to have diversity in the animals that are using the pasture and in the species of the types of plants that are growing in the pasture as well. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I could give you a big list of grasses, but yeah, we use oats are our like mainstay in the winter, oats and ryegrass, and sometimes wheat, which you think of wheat, you think of the grain, but it's the actual plant in its green state. What am I trying to say? In vegetative state. Is that the word I'm looking for? Yeah, I guess so. Before it goes to seed that we graze the cattle on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's been a big topic in circles that really care about nutritional food, regenerative farming, broadly, obviously white oaks, going over Rogan, like really put a big splash in the market of people like, all right, we should care about this. Alan Savory obviously been writing about this for a while.
Right.
And I guess that's the big question is like, is this scalable to do regenerative farming, produce this nutritious food, and then get it to market? I think that's something that you're trying to solve with local pastures or maybe not scaling, but accessibility at the very least too.
Well, that's a really important conversation. And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I don't know that regenerative farming is scalable in the same way that like the mass produced agriculture we have in America is. And what's interesting about it, and I think this is kind of what Will Harris said, is, you know, and I kind of share his view that probably the answer is not massive at scale regenerative operations, but it's lots of smaller farms that are providing food for the local population, you know, which is kind of going back to the way things used to work. You know, if you take our store Local Pastures, for example, it's a successful concept because people want to be able to access food straight from their farms, straight from local farms. But most people don't want to get up early on Saturday morning and go to the market, and almost nobody wants to drive 2 hours to my farm to go pick up an order. Some people do, and we like that. But having the store makes it really easy. It makes it easy for us. We keep the product there. We've got great staff, and people can show up and buy the product, and it works. But it's hard to recreate at scale. I've thought to myself, well, what could Local Pastures become? And I don't have any aspiration to go be the next John Mackey or something. But like, our supply chain is incredibly fragmented. And we, myself, Chertel, and Belvie, our partner in Local Pastures, are producing more than half of all the product we sell through the store. And so like, if we were to try to scale that to be something that was like a big box store concept, I couldn't imagine how that could work well, unless the business that owned the store was also producing like the bulk of the staple items that that store needs in order to survive. And the reason I say that is because when you source from local farms, it's a good outlet for local farms. We pay a fair price that makes sense for them. We're not like beating them down, and we charge what needs to be charged in order to us justify us running the store and to make sure the farmer's getting what they need. But it's hard to keep consistent supply of everything all the time. And I think the idea of having like these this massive system that's just really efficient and streamlined would be tough. And then that opens the door to like big brands that come in and greenwash and make you believe that they're checking all the boxes, and they come up with these third party verification entities, and then their merchandising and marketing is got all the right words in it. But then when you go and investigate, you realize like maybe everything isn't totally above board. And so the integrity, decreases as you scale that. I'm not saying it's not possible, but I think probably the answer to, improving the system isn't to eliminate the existing system. It's to get more farmers on board with the idea of implementing regenerative practices and educating them on that, and also strengthening the systems that promote the relationship between the consumer and the local farmer.
This rip is brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
Well, and I think Local Pastures is a great proof, not even a proof of concept, but like a great example that aspiring farmers can look at. It's like, oh, I can actually get some distribution. I don't have to depend on the weekend farmers markets to sell. And actually, this is probably a good opportunity to get in like how Local Pastures came to be. You were just telling us some conversations on Saturdays when things were slow. You were just spitballing ideas.
So Aubrey, he and his wife Perrin own Belvie, and my wife and I own Chertel. And so we were neighbors at the downtown Austin farmers market for years, every Saturday morning, and we're getting our farms ramped up so we would obviously became friends, and Aubrey had told me about, we're always thinking about like, how can we sell more product efficiently to customers, because we both have been burned trying to wholesale our products through distributors, or not burned all the time. A few times, yes, but we had wholesale. We had sold our products in big grocery stores and through restaurant distributors, and it was great for moving product, but the margins became very, very low, if not break even or slightly negative at times. And so, and we realized that our business thrives when we're selling to the customer that's going to consume the product, because it's relative to what it costs, like, HEB to sell a steak. Like, our input costs on a steak are much higher, because the way we do things is less efficient. And so anyway, we realized that the wholesale approach, which initially I thought was the way I was going to scale my farm and make it a great business, was, oh, I'm going to sell to restaurants and, so we realized, like, selling to the direct consumer is the way to go. And so we would talk about that. And he Aubrey had seen in France a mobile butcher farm stand deal where the guy was selling pork chops and steak, or maybe duck, out of this refrigerated glass case that, like, came out of the side of a cart that they'd park on the side of the street. And he's like, oh, that'd be really cool to have and take to the markets and sell out of, or go park different places. And I was like, yeah, man, I got this old Airstream. And I was thinking about, like, having, like, a farm stand, like ice cream truck style, parked in a neighborhood in Austin where we, you know, people can get their eggs and meat 7 days a week, you know? And probably a year and a half, 2 years of us talking about it. And then finally we were like, well, we want to actually do something, or just keep having this conversation and putting it off. And so we pulled the trigger, and through lots of trials and tribulations of getting a trailer set up and getting ripped off by a guy we hired to build a trailer. And we decided not to use the Airstream. We ended up with the one that's on Altorf now. That's a little trailer that you can walk inside and shop and then open the North Lamar bigger store more recently. But yeah, that was interesting. And it really changed the game for our farms and for customers in Austin being able to access our products. So
yeah. How did you guys come on Altorf specifically? Because I think it's like prime location, right next to Austin Beer Garden.
Yeah.
It's like right up on the hill. It's got good visibility if you're driving down Altorf. It's like, what's that? And you've got like small parking lot there.
Well, if you shop at the downtown Austin Farmers Market, and this is probably true at a lot of farmers market, but there's a lot of interesting people that shop at the markets, and you don't know who the hell they are. I mean, like, all kinds of people that have done amazing things, or, have these really important roles in these organizations, and you have no idea who they are. Maybe years will go by before you realize, like, oh, that guy's like the world's leading orthopedic surgeon at this type of thing or whatever. Well, we had this one customer, Daryl Kunick, who's a great guy, and he's involved. He's, I think, one of the owners of Uchi and Uchi Co., and he's owned a bunch of restaurants and bars in Austin, and has real estate. And I told him what I was thinking about, and he was like, oh, I got this space that might work for you on Altorf. He owned at the time the office building across the road, and they had a lease on this parking area so we were, and he had these trailers he had been building to enhance his other properties. And so, yeah, it just so happened. He's like, I'll rent you this trailer. And so that worked out, and that was really cool. So it was fortuitous. He's someone who's part of the community of people that source from local farms and is passionate about that. And he wanted to help us out. So,
yeah. But every time I go in there, I nerd out, because one of my favorite books, I've had the author on, and something that's always in the back of my mind, it's a book called Strong Towns. I'm not sure if you heard about it, but it literally goes into the history of how strong towns, strong cities came to be, and it's like modular. And he's an economist as well. And most of the book is focused on, like, how do you actually build a strong town? It's via small local businesses that focus on revenue per square foot. And every time I walk into the Container on Altorf, I'm like, this is the most efficient revenue per square foot business I've ever seen in my life.
And that's important for a low margin business like a farm. You know what I mean? And like the original motivation was not even to sell anything else there. We just wanted to sell more of our own stuff from our farms. And so out of the gates, it was like, we had an agreement that, you know, we were going to just share the overhead of having the trailer, and we were going to sell our farm stuff there. And then, Of course, it's become a more robust concept now, but
yeah. And going back to like accessibility to for consumers and having that property, now multiple properties there 7 days a week that people can go to is massive. Yeah. 'Cause like I was telling you out there, we go to the farmer's market when we can on Saturday mornings, but now we've got soccer, T-ball, a number of things we got to run.
Oh, yeah.
Like being able to go there, my wife, whenever she wants during the week, like, we're going to cook meatballs tonight. Let me go get some ground beef.
Yeah.
It's like extremely convenient. And that's mm-hmm. not only an unlock for the consumer, but it has to be for you. You were describing like the intricacies of farmer's markets. Like you could have a bad weather week, a bad
judgment call on when to cancel the market because it is sprinkled outside or something like
and
that.
So that, like, you don't have to dive into hard numbers, but like how much business does that open up for you, being able to have these physical locations?
A lot. I mean, you know, I can speak about SureTail, without offending my partners, but you know, SureTail, you know, will probably double our overall sales, between when we started the stores and the end of this year. And we were doing, 1.4 million in sales, not bad for a little farm, you know, I mean, And so yeah, it's been meaningful. And it's also like, I'm not going to say high margin because nothing's high margin, but it's not that break even business. We were, you know, running a truck and driving to San Antonio and delivering a truck of eggs to the, you know, HEB Central Market, distribution center. And then, you know, running all over the place. And then it's like, yeah, I did this great revenue number. And I made, you know, I've talked about this before. The first year we broke $1 million in sales a few years ago, I was like, oh, that's great. What a milestone. And then I looked at the P&L and I was like, we made $5,000. And that year we received a $20,000 PPP or PPO loan from the government, one of the COVID money thing. So I'm like, really, we would have been a little negative that year. And we didn't even pay ourselves. You know, I mean, so it's like, it's tricky, but yeah, going back to your question, it's been tremendous. And I know it's been helpful in helping other local brands. Mother Culture is a brand we're very close with. They make amazing yogurt products. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've scaled their business through Local Pastures successfully as well. So
yeah, their kefir is really good too.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Their key lime yogurt is dangerous.
See, I'm all about the maple pecan, but yeah, everybody's got their favorites.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores. Connect your wallets or custodial accounts and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
Reason I reached out to you originally in the is because Parker out there, he was tweeting, obviously big SureTail yeah. fan, buying eggs every week. And that's one thing we focus on here at Bitcoin Podcast, economics tilt, particularly focus on like inflation and how fucked up the monetary system is and mm-hmm. the effects that has on every individual and every business out there. And he tweeted about the price of eggs going up. And I think SureTail I think you hopped in and explained, and that's why I wanted to bring you on. Like, it's something that's on top of every American's mind right now, especially heading into an election. Inflation post-COVID has been insane. It affects everybody. And it's the understanding how it affects your business, why you guys have to raise prices, and more importantly, like, what you think it's going to take to sort of reverse this feedback loop that we found ourselves in with prices going up.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's funny about our business is in the first several years of getting the farm started, we were just learning how to do it. And so I was in the field all the time. My wife was in the field all the time and, you know, building chicken houses and learning how to run a planter and fix the damn thing and what seeds to plant, how deep to plant them and when you're supposed to plant and, you know, how to rotationally graze cattle and all these things that managing our business was like not something that really happened. It was like, yeah, there's enough to pay the feed bill. Yep, there's enough to buy the fuel. And that's how I talk about like ending up at the end of a year where we sold $1 million in product and like, oh, realizing like the business didn't make any money. So anyway, we were so focused on that, you know, it is hard to watch costs in real time. And so you could get, you know, surprised pretty easily. And so then we get into COVID and there's actually a surge in sales for a lot of small farms like ours, because people started being mindful of where their food was coming from and the fact that they couldn't get certain things to the grocery store. And so that was a good thing. But then the surge of inflation came afterwards and it was pretty quick and pretty insane. Of course, fuel is the only one that comes to mind that has gone back down. Mm-hmm. And that's an important thing to remember is like inflation doesn't usually go in reverse. You know, once the prices go up, even if the input costs for the guy selling you stuff went back down, like they're going to leave their price alone, right? I mean, that's just how it works historically, if you look at that. So, we had another year. We sold more and did slightly worse from a profitability standpoint. And you know, we try to find this balance because we want to, we're, like I said, outside, we're a mission-driven business. Like, first and foremost, we're there to do a good thing and to add value, but we can't do it for free or pay to do it, you know? And so, yeah, and I remember after that first full year of crazy inflation, where they said it was 9% or whatever, for us it was more. And it's like, you may see 9% across the board, but for certain businesses it was a lot more, right? Like our packaging cost, our feed cost, our processing cost, obviously fuel was bonkers for a while. I mean, we went from spending $3,500 a month on fuel to spending $6,000, $7,000 a month on fuel, running the tractors and the delivery truck and whatever. So we had kind of a come to Jesus with ourselves, and that's the point at which I realized like I actually kind of needed to start managing my business. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of small farmers get stuck, is because they want to go out and be a farmer. And it's like, okay, well, you get to a certain size and like, you kind of have to sit in an office some of the time and like look at spreadsheets and manage cash flow and project that stuff out. And like, what are my costs? And okay, last year I slaughtered 230 head of cattle and I sold this much of all these cuts. And like, well, what was my cost to produce a ribeye and where should it be priced, you know? And it's like, it gets kind of granular and boring, but that has to happen in order for your business to be able to function and have it not be a charity. And so it was hard for us to kind of get back to your question. It was hard for us to navigate inflation. But we have had to go up on prices a couple of times over the last couple of years. And recently we did on eggs and by about 9% and about 7% on our meats. And the reason there's been some delays in us doing that has been because like, it's so hard to track in real time. I kind of have to look like at a year's worth of data and then go, okay, what did it cost us during that year? And you know, what should have been different? And so, yeah, it's because there's so much variability in our business, right? you can have a year and go, okay, on a typical year, you're going to get this much rain. You're going to plant your seed. It's going to yield this much forage, and your cattle are going to eat that, and then you're going to get this much beef. But then you get a drought like we've had the last, not this last summer, but the two summers before. And it's like, okay, well, now you got to come up with 40 grand to ship in a bunch of hay you didn't have budgeted to feed your cattle. it's just bonkers. So in real time, trying to track all that, it's really tough. It's not like your cost of goods is like one or two things, you know?
No, that's something we've been passionate about here in the Commons and in the small Bitcoin group. And then Austin, like I've lived in Philly, Chicago, New York, Charleston. By far, Austin is like the most health conscious city I've ever lived in.
Yeah.
And so whether it's like the Bitcoin community, which has really made an effort to go introduce ourselves to ranchers like yourself and
yeah.
other farmers in the area to get good quality food, or the Meat Mafia guys and what they've been doing.
Yeah.
To really drive forward, like being health conscious and focusing on focusing on your health and eating good food. And I think this is just an idea, a problem we've all, at least the 3 years I've been here, like how the hell do we solve it? Like you can see how passionate Parker was about it. Like how do we replicate this model and get healthy food at somewhat affordable prices to more people? Like, and I think what you said earlier, and what Will Harris has been beating the drum about, is probably the way is more distributed small farms, selling directly to consumer. And I think local pastures is a great model of, okay, there's a step. Here's a step in the right direction towards that ultimate goal. And that, again, because if you look at it right now, like, obviously, Kelly Means and many others have been hitting the circuit talking about the problems that exist within our industrialized food system. Mm-hmm. And it seems like we're maybe at a fork in a road where it's like we can go hyper-centralized and systemically fragile.
Yeah, very.
Or figure out how to solve this problem.
I think a more robust system is a more fragmented system where you've got these sort of... what am I trying to say? Like these agricultural communities that are supporting these metropolitan areas, and you've got lots of those. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder to break that.
Do you think we're moving in the right direction? Or
I think, you know, I don't know if I've been doing it long enough to really have a point of reference to say one way or the other, but I know that there's, I mean, it's helpful that people like Joe Rogan are having the conversation and getting people to open their minds to acknowledge that there's a problem and what a better solution might be. And it's great to have these conversations, you know, but it's a long road. And I'm very careful not to demonize agricultural producers in America, because I know a lot of people that, you know, my family grew wheat in Kansas, my grandparents and great grandparents, and I grew up around that in the summers. And like the farmers that farm that land are some of the most intelligent, hardworking, salt of the earth people. But you know, there's a system that's been put in place that people have been born into, that now you've got multiple generations that have been farming in this way, where they rely on third party inputs to overcome the imbalances that are created by monocultures or monocrops, monocropping, and confinement feeding operations and things like that, which are inherently just not the way nature works. And so I think the real answer is in obviously supporting, like I said, supporting the relationship between the existing small farmers and the consumers, and also like for the larger producers that are selling into the commodity markets and things with grains and beef and whatnot, just to open their minds that they're the best equipped people to have scaled regenerative operations, right? They've already got the land. They've got the basic know-how of how to grow a crop and how to be a good animal husbandry and how to take care of cattle and pigs and these sorts of things. So if you could get those people to start thinking differently about how they approach agricultural production, I think you could see some really interesting things happen. And Will Harris is a great example of that. I mean, he was a conventional cow-calf operator, I believe, and on a 3,000-acre ranch that he inherited. And, you know, he saw a market, a need for all natural and then grass-fed beef. and look what he's done now, you know, and he'll even tell you his business isn't hugely profitable. I think last I heard they were doing 20 something million a year in sales, and I don't know what their margins are, but I know they have a lot of loss leader components of their business, their leather goods, and I think poultry production wasn't so hot. I heard him say in a talk he gave once, but like clearly they're making it work, and they're a great example of what's possible. So you know, and they control their customer base and they set their own pricing, you know, based on what the market will bear and based on what their input costs are. And as opposed to just being beholden to the commodity markets, like, boy, I sure hope cattle prices are good this year. Cause if they're not, you know,
shit out of luck.
Yeah.
Have you noticed any changes in your farm since you've been tending it to it specifically with this regenerative?
Oh yeah. In terms of the soil and stuff, yeah. Man. Yeah. It's really interesting. And I do soil testing and I have data, but I haven't compiled it. And I'm actually writing a book right now about, you know, leaving the city and starting the farm and all that. And I probably will include this stuff in there, but yeah, we've seen, so our pasture, the bigger pasture we have across the road from our house was historically farmed for corn and cotton. They grow out there. And just to give you, and forgive my being so verbose, but it's, I have a lot to say, but they, in the old days, the German immigrants that originally lived on my farm were primarily subsistence farmers. Okay. And then in order to bring in income, they would grow cotton as much as they could pick by hand. These weren't slave owners. These were a family of immigrants that would go out and pick the cotton that they grew, and they could sell that for cash. And then they would raise beef cattle to sell for cash. In order to feed the beef cattle in the winter, they would grow corn out alongside the cotton. So they'd have a section of cotton, a section of corn. And then there was hay meadows for hay for the cattle in the winter. And then they'd graze the cattle in the warm season. But the way they farmed was that they would just plant corn and cotton, and they wouldn't, you know, put anything back in. And they didn't know about rotational grazing and regenerative agriculture back then. The land was pretty fertile still. Well, over the years, the land got really depleted. So when we bought the farm, the pasture out across the road, it's black land, it's black dirt. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of life there. And also it had been overgrazed by the rancher that had grazed cattle there previously. So I'll never forget the first year we pulled cattle off of it for a while, and we went in and no-tilled the whole thing in hairy vetch, which is a legume, to allow the pasture to allow the legumes to bring nitrogen into the soil, fix nitrogen in the soil in preparation for grazing our calves in the spring. And man, that pasture came to life. It was unreal. The volunteer clovers and rye grasses and other cool season grasses that came out were impressive. And then over the years, we started rotating our laying hens on that pasture. So every Thursday, all of our laying hen coops get moved. So they're constantly rotating across the pasture. And wherever they spend the summer, the cattle will graze in the winter. And wherever the hens spend the winter, the cattle will then graze in the summer after the hens move off. And so we've seen tremendous changes in the quality of our pasture overall and its ability to sustain our herd. Now, the other important thing to note there, if you're a regenerative ag geek like I am, is that probably one of the most impactful things we've done is to use a managed rotational grazing system for our cattle so that the pasture is not being overgrazed and the manure and urine is highly concentrated with wherever the cattle are going. And then layering on top of that, our laying hens constantly moving around the pasture. Oh, it's been tremendous. But it takes time to get that, you know, to see those results too.
Well, that's a big worry, particularly like the monoculture that exists throughout a lot of American farmland. That's,
yeah.
I mean, we've talked to Slim and Cole, and that's like the big worry is like in parts of the country where you have this monoculture that exists, there's planting and harvesting the same crops year in and year out. Like that soil is dying. And
well, and the tillage too.
Yeah.
It's destroying the structure in the soil. And yeah.
But so are you an example of like things can turn around?
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah. I mean, I firmly believe that the earth wants to fix itself. Nature mm-hmm. wants to fix itself, and it will if you let it. I do. But again, you got to wean people off of the system that they've been born into, which is like, hey, you take this input, you put it there, you do this, you get this yield, and it's going to work. And it works for now, but at whose expense? You know what I mean? And also, like, there's not a big conversation about quality. Like, okay, you can talk about how you can buy ground beef at Walmart for $3.50 and mine's $10 a pound. Okay, fine. But what about like the cost per pound of like quality, you know what I mean? Of nutrient density and how do you measure that? I mean, that's the conversation people aren't having. And the commodity market in America is generally not incentivizing producers to, they're not giving them a premium of like, oh, this is a more nutrient dense cucumber. Like, I don't give a shit. I just want, you know, X number of pounds of cucumbers. You know, right?
Well, and this is something that has to be consumer driven at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And that's it'd be interesting to get your thoughts. Like, it seems like we're at this point where these topics are being pushed to the front and center of the national conversation. Big push against seed oils.
Yeah.
In recent years, obviously MAHA. You have RFK joining Trump's campaign, mm-hmm. and Trump is promising to let him come in and really focus on healthcare and the food systems. We've seen people on Capitol Hill in recent weeks just talking about the absolute garbage that we're feeding children. And
yeah. Oh yeah.
The effects. And I know my wife, I think it's funny when you have kids, like you become hyper-conscious of this, and something my wife, that's why she's at local pastures every week, because she really cares what we're feeding the boys. And it is pretty messed up what we've done over the last 2-3 generations in the United States with normalizing this industrial sludge that we're feeding everybody.
I grew up in the 80s. I would regularly, as a snack, my mom would regularly slice off a piece of Velveeta for me to eat. And like, we had Hot Pockets and Coke and all this stuff in our house. And I fortunately had my own sort of awakening about nutrition and everything. And it was before the farm, but really my thinking really changed when I started the farm and started producing food, and then started coming into contact with people at farmers markets that were, you know, way ahead of me on this stuff. You know, people like Paul Saladino, you know, and guys like that put out great content talking about what was wrong with the American diet. I mean, it's just a few fundamentals. If you make some tweaks, you're going to see a world of difference there. But with kids, it's tough because, like I said, I grew up eating garbage, like a lot of people in the 80s did, because you know, fat was the enemy.
It didn't stop in the 90s, by the way.
No, yeah.
We were eating Fun Dip and all that stuff.
But like, and then there's also part of me that's like, I go out with my kids and they want to have a burger and a Coke or a Dr. Pepper. And I'm like, well, I don't want you to never be able to have a Dr. Pepper. But, you know, it's just, you know, I also want them to be mindful of like why that's something that we don't consume every meal. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Anyway.
It is like the thinking back to growing up, and you had like 3 different 2-liter bottles of soda in the fridge at a given point in time. It's like, maybe you shouldn't have done that. And that's, I mean, if we're going to solve this, because it is a massive problem, that, and going back to like cost, that's what I think the American consumer and policymakers need to recognize as well. Because you may be buying this quote unquote cheaper, less nutrient dense food, right, and it may seem like it's cheaper, but actually in the long run, when you factor in health costs, it's way more expensive sometimes for the individual, but inarguably for the American taxpayer, sort of subsidizing this healthcare system.
Yeah, and it's like, it'll keep you alive, I guess, but you know, people should be thriving, and you know, we need to, I think, a direct result of the changes that we want to see in the food system would be lower rates of chronic disease and things like that. It's funny, there's an old rancher that I know that I was talking to that lives out near us, and one year he had a field of hay that was overmatured, gotten rained on. It was like way past when you should cut it. And at that point, it's pretty much just fiber. It's like the cows in some cases can burn more calories chewing it than they actually get from it. But his response was, it'll make a turd, you know, and it's like, I'm going to feed it because I have it and it'll make a turd. And it's like, okay. Whereas on our farm, we won't touch stuff like that because I actually need nutrition to go into my cattle so I can produce quality beef. So it's kind of like the same thing. Like you feed your kids a bunch of crap. It's like, yeah, it'll make a turd, but like, what are you going to get out of it? You
know? So. And how do you even produce nutritional cattle? Like, how do you know? It's trying to figure out how to frame this question, but like, what are the inputs that lead to quality, nutrient dense cattle?
Well, I mean, okay. So, well, in the case I was referring to, I mean, that guy runs a cow calf operation. So, he's not selling meat. He's got mama cows that, and they supplement with processed, you know, grain based, cubes, feed, you know, cattle feed. But like for our program, so we're a 100% grass-fed, grass-finished program. So we use no grain in feeding our cattle. And so it's a way less efficient way to put weight on cattle. So to put in that, to give you an example of that, to put in context, we will achieve about 1,000 pounds live weight, depending on the year and the rainfall and forage quality. Usually you can expect at about 24 months of age that I can get a steer to be about 1,000 pound live weight. Mm-hmm. A feedlot can take a calf and achieve, you know, maybe a 1,300-1,400 pound live weight at 14 months old or younger. So you think about how much quicker they can do that than I can. And they do that by feeding high calorie, you know, often corn and other grains to those cattle. And it's not just straight corn usually either. It's there's other byproducts. I can't remember the name of it, but there's other protein sources and stuff that are sort of, I don't know if synthesized is the right word, but they're obtained by processing other plant ingredients, or sometimes they'll even use like chicken litter from poultry houses and things like that. So they're feeding cheap stuff. And more importantly, like I'm not one to demonize grain finishing cattle, if that's what you're into, but you know, to do it with high quality grains, I suppose would be the better option. Because what happens is a lot of the massively produced grains in America, soybeans and corn and Milo and things like that, are, you know, produced in soils that have routinely been sprayed with herbicides and glyphosate in some cases. And those herbicides tie up metals in the soil and make them unavailable to the plant. And so those plants actually are less nutrient dense than if they were grown in a more organic fashion without those inputs. And then those cattle are eating that. And so they're getting less of some of those micronutrients that they need. And so then the meat that you produce off those cattle is therefore less nutrient dense. I don't have lab data for this, and I actually should send some, I'd like to do that actually, but we know fundamentally that that's true, you know?
Yeah. Then not only are they not getting the nutrients, they're sucking up those herbicides and glyphosate.
Yeah, and they're eating, you know, going back to the grain thing, I mean, they're eating grains which they really aren't evolved to do. So it's not, you know, cattle, you know, bison on the prairie weren't going around seeking out, like, you know, corn cobs and shit. I mean, they eat grass. That's what they, the leaf of the plant is what they're really meant to eat.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. Again, it feels like we're at a crossroads where I think the zeitgeist is waking up to, we should be more conscious about this. I mean, I can just tell, maybe it's the bubble that we're in Austin, but even in my extended family back in Philadelphia, cousins are still, or more cognizant of what we're feeding the kids. And, mm-hmm. And again, going back to like cost, like imagine if we were able to transition to a consumer, it's the word I'm looking for, pattern where people are making the conscious decision to buy more healthy goods, and the Goldfish of the world and all the high fructose corn syrup mm-hmm. based products just aren't being bought anymore. And
yeah.
We sort of had this shift of capital towards farmers, ranchers like yourself that are actually providing good food.
Right.
What could that do to prices overall and accessibility to this good food?
Yeah. And like, I mean, there's multiple tiers to improving, like consumers improving their own lives by making better decisions at the grocery store. And the first one is like, even if you're like really on a limited budget, just to buy the produce and the meats and not all the packaged shit would be number one. And then to further optimize, it's like, well, what's the quality of the produce and meats that you're getting? Like, could you get better? And now that you're not buying all the packaged, you know, Stouffer's and sodas and all this crap, like maybe you could afford to, maybe you'd spend a little less or the same amount, you know, but you'd get way more nutritional density per pound of food purchase than you were getting before, you know?
Yeah. And you're less hungry. All that shit makes you hungrier at the end of the day too. The packaged shit.
Dude. Yeah. I mean, I've been eating animal based for over 3 years now. And it's like, you know, I go to a restaurant and they try to fill you up with French fries and bread. You know, that's mm-hmm. the bulk of what you're getting at those places. And so I'm the crazy guy that'll order the double meat portion. And so, but like I can eat a steak or a pound of our caveman blend or ground beef, and that satiates me for forever. Whereas, you know, you eat a quarter pound hamburger with a bunch of fries and stuff and you're hungry again pretty quick. You know?
Yeah. It's not great. Not great, Bob. But like going back to like local pastures and building on this idea of creating a business plan and environment where this can be replicated throughout the country. Like now that you have the brick and mortar store up on North Lamar, like what are some of the learnings there? And like, what are some ideas you have that like taking it to the next level and or basically looking backwards at other farmers and saying, hey, here's the blueprint.
Yeah. Well, we're still learning. I will say that the trailer, the original store on Old Torf, was great because, like you said, it was, you know, great productivity per square foot of leased space. But you know, there were some limitations because it wasn't the greatest customer experience, and also we had trouble keeping enough back stock on, you know. So one of the reasons for wanting to do the bigger store was not only to have a more relaxed shopping experience for people that came in the store, but also to have more storage. And we've got big walk-in refrigeration and freezers in the back there. So I don't know. I could see us maybe doing more trailers in the future, honestly, and using that as kind of our central hub for stocking them. I will say that none of us have a really big vision for how big we could make it or anything like that. The Belvie, Aubrey and Prentice Belvie and my wife, Carolyn, and I, none of us are. And again, this is still a mission driven business and that has to be profitable. And so, you know, it would make us happy to see people doing this in other areas.
I'm partly asking selfishly because that's like, my wife and I talk about this a lot. We're from Philadelphia originally, and we'll likely move back there.
Yeah.
Eventually be with our family. And that's like, she's like, I want to start this up there when we move back. And like, do you think it needs to be a farmer that starts something like this?
You know, there are a lot of people try these concepts who aren't producers, and it can be done. And because I've sold to some of these people, and it's challenging though, because so most small farms are just that. They're small farms and they're selling at a farmer's market and they're maybe selling to a few restaurants, and then when they get wholesale accounts like a grocery store, that's actually like their lowest priority account. And so when production wanes and they don't have as much of something, those guys get cut. And so what I see from people who go and start stores like this is they're pulling their hair out because their egg supplier no longer has eggs for them, or they can't get pork for another 2 months or whatever it is. And meanwhile, they've got rent to pay and they've got customers going, what the hell, dude, I need to make a pork casserole tonight, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard because of that. So the fact that my partners and I are producing the bulk of the core products that we sell certainly helps, because we are producers for the store. And that's our priority. So we're going to keep our store stocked. Whereas if you're just an individual that wants to start this, a business like this, it's tough. Now, what those guys end up having to do is, you look at like ButcherBox or any of these guys, because they're going to have the same problems, right? Is they've got to go find ways to get that product at scale, at a scale that matches whatever their demand is. And then you run into integrity issues in a lot of cases. And I've saw this where there was a company called Farmhouse Delivery in Austin that was really cool concept and really well-intentioned too. But when they couldn't get enough of something, they would go and get like 44 Farms beef. It's local. It's from Texas. It's not that far away. But they're a big, you know, big cattle operation. They send calves to the feedlot. It's feedlot beef. It's just got a nice brand stamp on it. And the headquarters is, I think, in Cameron, Texas, you know. And so it looks nice. And you can say, I've got local beef on the menu or whatever. But it's really, it's like, it's the same thing, right? As what you're going to get. It's feedlot beef, you know. And so then it's like, is that really the same as, you know, is that comparable to, you know, Jim's farm over here that runs 30 head of cattle? And when he's out of beef, he's out of beef for the year. And then he'll slaughter the next calf crop the next year. Like, no, it's not. But most consumers aren't really mindful of that, you mm-hmm. know? And so it's a very long-winded response to your question, but I think it can be done. But it's hard. And then on the flip side, like, okay, we're producers, we own this business, like, where can we take it? Well, we're probably limited in how big we can scale it and maintain our ability to keep our store stocked all the time and not have the same problems, because, you know, we are limited in how much we can produce ultimately. And also our supply chain for the rest of the products we sell is incredibly fragmented. Like, no one of those vendors can just produce as much as we ask for. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, yeah, that's just like, you know, that's what happens when you go back to a system that's driven by local producers that are limited by weather and seasonality. It's like, I can't give you cantaloupe in December mm-hmm. unless it came from,
you see that you with know. Raw milk in the summer, it's harder to get.
Yeah. It gets harder to get. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're not going to die without it. It'll come back. But yeah, that's.
Is this something you would recommend that other small producers around the country begin doing?
Well, pastures. If it makes sense for them, I know a lot of folks have done well with on-farm stores. If you're in an area that's accessible, a little bit closer in, you going to say something?
Farm we go to often in the summer, we go up to New Jersey Shore, and there's a farm, Beach Plum Farms in Cape May.
Okay.
They have an on,
Cape May, yeah.
They have a on-farm store that yep. we go to once a week, and
yeah, it's great. I think that's a way that these farms can thrive. And even like the agritourism thing, which I've kind of shied away from because I don't want to be a tour guide. We, you know, we have an Airbnb on our farm. So if people book the Airbnb and they want a tour, I'll give them a tour. Otherwise, I don't really do tours just because I've got other stuff I got to do. But like that's a way to do it. I think, The problem with opening a store is it's a whole nother business. And I am so thankful that I have the business partners that I have and to share that the burden of that with, because it's a nightmare. I mean, I've had like last year, Thanksgiving evening, Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve were all thwarted by freezers that went out at the store. You know, it was like, what's God trying to tell me, man? And you know, managing refrigeration, and fortunately we've had pretty good experience with all of our staff, but you know, it's just a whole nother set of headaches. So, you know, it can work, but, I think every farm's going to be at a different point. Fortunately, we've scaled our farm to the point where I made a conscious decision to pull myself out of the field for the most part and actually work on my farm, not in it. And I don't love that because I like being out in the field, and I still am when we're making hay or doing planting or working the cattle. But day to day, people know Sam's going to check in the morning, and then he's going to go to the office or go check on the stores and make things happen and make sure that you know the layer feed is ordered and that we've got you know, the tractor parts we need so we can fix that thing, and that there's a plan for replacing our laying hen flocks for the new year, and there's money in the bank to pay the bills, and it's a tremendous amount of effort that goes into that. And so it's not really what I envisioned for myself when I started farming, but
it's necessary.
It's necessary. And I tell everybody, like, people come work at the farm and they're like, ah, you know, this is hard work, or this, you know, this sucks, or whatever. I'm like, yeah, it's all grunt work. Whether you're in the office trying to figure out how to make sure there's enough money there, or if you're working in the freezer, organizing inventory, or packing the truck, or working the farmer's market, or planting, or whatever you're doing, it's all grunt work that results in beautiful things, you know? So
yeah, grunt work is something that people have shied away from.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like people want to get back to it. And you mentioned you're writing a book, City to Farm. What's going to be in the book? What inspired you to write it?
I get approached a lot by people who ask about how I made the transition or made the decision to do it and what it's been like. And all these people, a lot of people come stay at the Airbnb on the farm, or they'll come visit the farm, or I'll see them at a farmer's market or bump into them somewhere. And I hear the same thing from so many people that they're like, oh yeah, I've got this job, I make good money, but I'm disenchanted, and we want to buy some land, and we want to go and live a different life and be more connected to nature. And I'm like, that's exactly where I was at. And the difference is I made this leap, which, like, our whole family thought we were nuts, by the way. But I suppose, you know, part of it I'm doing because it's sort of a process of self-realization, and there's something therapeutic about sitting down and writing and just kind of mapping out where you're at with things and why you did things. And so maybe it's selfish to some degree, but it's also because I want to share that with people and maybe provide inspiration, or at least just somebody's account of what it was like for them when they made a change in their life. I think we'd be better off if more people didn't subscribe to this path they think they need to take in life. Like, there's nothing wrong. We need bankers. We need program. We need all lawyers and all these things, but, like, you don't have to do that. Like, you know, there's other stuff out there. And also, like, money doesn't have to be your God. You know, we all got to make money to live, but, like, do you really want to have, like, a Learjet and a Rolls Royce? Like, that's what gets programmed into our kids' minds. My kids are obsessed with Lamborghinis right now. And I'm like, where did this come from?
Are they into crypto by chance?
Not yet. So anyway, yeah. But yeah, that's kind of what that's all about.
Do you feel more fulfilled?
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. You know, I didn't grow up. My dad wasn't an outdoorsman. He wasn't handy. And so I had all these things I wanted to know how to do, like fix stuff and hunt and skin a deer and just go out in nature and, like, get food. Most humans don't know how to do that. Nope. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I one thing I'm writing about now is, like, the first time I killed a deer on the farm and what that process was like, and having to track it and field dress it and take it home and skin it. And then, you know, I'm watching YouTube videos while I'm doing it, and my kids are running around, and, like, I don't know what I'm doing, but, you know, it's an amazing thing. And, like, I'm this guy that was flying first class, going to New York and meeting with clients and doing it. And it's like, in your 20s, you're like, yeah, this is cool. And then you kind of have kids, and you have a different perspective of life, and you're like, what the fuck am I doing? Mm-hmm. I don't care about any of this. No hotel room in the world is better than my own bed. And I would never want to be anywhere more than I want to be home with my family, you know, and having cool experiences with my kids. And so, you know, the advertising business that we had sold, and before I started my own advertising business, I was kind of courted to run the Austin office of that business afterwards. And I met with the corporate guys, and they were telling me about what that would look like. And I remember asking, I was like, how do you deal with the fact that you're traveling all the time? Are you No. Oh, okay. How do you deal with the fact that you're traveling all the time and, you know, and it just seems like really hectic? And he's like, oh, it's great, man. I collect so many miles. I don't even have to pay for my family vacations. Plus, I get out of having to go to my daughter's dance recitals. And I remember in that moment, I was like, fuck this. Fuck this, dude. This is stupid. So.
No, that's, I mean, I travel a lot and the... It's tough. I don't like traveling. I don't like I don't like airports.
No.
It's necessary for my job, but I have the flexibility on the back end where I can set my schedule outside of when I'm traveling and try to be there, but completely agree. Like,
yeah,
I get getting to the point now, particularly my oldest starting to play sports. Like, I don't want to miss that. And
no.
It's something you have to prioritize. Like,
well, that's what started happening to us with farmers markets. You know, a year and a half ago, my wife's a little earlier, but me, I stopped going about a year and a half ago every weekend because I was missing my son's football games and, you know, and just working the farmer's markets. But yeah, if you're, you know, living the corporate life and traveling a lot or whatever, corporate or not corporate, you're traveling a lot and you're gone a lot. It's obviously not like the best for your kids. You know, it's better for them to have parents around. So.
Yeah. Shrunk to, like, we know, like I said, we go to Jersey in the summers, and that's my favorite 3 months of the year because working from home down there. And
yeah, you stay in Cape May for 3 months?
Cape May County, yeah. A little north of Cape May, but
cool.
It's a great vibe, just being able, especially when they're younger. They're so impressionable. It's like,
yeah,
you don't want to miss any of that.
That's neat that you can do that. Yeah. It's a lot of people get the heck out of here in Austin in the summer.
It gets hot.
It's the heat.
It gets hot. we're from the Northeast. It gets a little too hot for our comfort down there. The other thing, I mean, it would be remiss of me. This is a Bitcoin podcast. Like, you guys accept Bitcoin for orders.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
Well, I am not an expert on Bitcoin. I acknowledge the merits of cryptocurrency as a way to transfer value without people sticking their nose in what you're doing. I can get down with that. I don't, as an asset class to hold, yeah, I just don't know, man. I own mostly land and land with houses on it. And, getting into that kind of conversation, you know, one reason I was able to start the farm and not pay myself for so long was that I own rental property in Austin. And then we have the Airbnb on the farm that, you know, produce some income. And so I'm a big proponent of owning land and owning property. But Bitcoin, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. That's the, we're big Bitcoiners here. We run this company on a Bitcoin standard. And that's the thesis for, like, holding Bitcoin as a business. It's helped us, like, buying everything in the studio. It's like I started selling ads for Bitcoin 6 years ago and trying to make sure that I was able to hold more than I was selling to run the business. And as the price has gone up, it's let me reinvest in the business.
Yeah.
And, that's sort of core to our thesis at 1031 to the fund that we have. We invest in companies that can provide value to customers and make a profit. Like, that's something that's been lost, particularly on VC funded companies.
Oh, in the
last 2 decades, is like, don't worry about making money, just grow and get as many customers and figure that out later. We're taking the opposite approach. It's like, make money, make profit, put it in the Bitcoin. And that's what we've seen on the business side. Businesses that adopt Bitcoin as a treasury asset benefit in the long run. Like, if you're able to hold it for at least a 4 year period, you'll find at the end of that 4 years that Bitcoin's worth more and you can reinvest in your business and do more things. And that's, Parker was mentioning earlier, that's another thing, is trying to figure out how to get Bitcoin in the hands of more businesses and accepting it, what you guys do, online via Strike, is something that we're trying to solve, particularly here in Austin. The crew here at the Commons, is there's a ton of us Bitcoiners here that would love to go spend our Bitcoin to support businesses that are accepting it and sort of begin the transition away from that system where you can be snooped on, there's middlemen and all that stuff.
Well, and I, you know, the more businesses that accept Bitcoin, I think the more easy it'll be for people to adopt it. Because, like, one of my big hangups for holding Bitcoin or using it regularly in my life is that most of the things that we need to buy, I can't pay for with Bitcoin. Inputs for the farm and things like that. They kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird world we find ourselves in, the Bitcoin world. It's funny. We've been the, the crazy people saying maybe we should focus on the money. Because again, going back to inflation, that's the biggest worry, is that the government and the central banks print so much money that it becomes almost impossible to facilitate just economic activity, because prices get haywire.
Right.
It seems like we're getting back into a monetary policy that's probably going to be inflationary moving forward. The Fed lowering rates, wars popping up, like they're probably going to have to print more money. So it's like, let's start having the conversation about transitioning to a better money that actually cannot be debased and allows you to save all the hard work that you're doing, whether it's you, me, you at the farm, me at the media company, the venture firm. Like, you want to be able to secure that hard work and that value of that work in an asset that's not going to be able to be printed because somebody decides to go hit a button and says, there's $9 trillion more dollars in the economy now.
Yeah.
We do have a final question on the show now.
Okay.
Which is, what is something, a prediction or an idea that you have within your industry that you think nobody would agree with you on?
A prediction or an idea within my industry that I don't think anybody would agree with me on. I don't know that people would overwhelmingly disagree with my predictions. You know, I'm actually a pretty optimistic person when it comes to looking ahead at the future. And the trends that I'm seeing seem to suggest that there's a growing number of people becoming mindful of the food they're putting in their body. And a subset of those people are becoming really mindful and picky about who they source it from. So that's a promising trend for me. So I tend to think that that's going to continue as more people, you know, gain clarity and start to realize that that most of what they're being told to purchase to put in their bodies is complete garbage.
You think it's going to happen fast or slow?
Well, you know, right now it's happening fast within like this certain sort of niche community of like, I don't know, like younger, intelligent, fitness minded. I know the Bitcoin community is very mindful of this. Like, there are certain, these niche communities that are really pushing that narrative, not pushing it, like, but like they're, you know, having those conversations. But you know, the real challenge is going to be in getting like the average day-to-day, you know, middle-class family to start going, you know what? I don't want to eat garbage anymore. You know, I'm going to, and we see them. I mean, we have customers like that. Now, one misconception we had when we started the farm is like, okay, our product is going to have to be more expensive than like the regular stuff at the grocery store. So I guess it's like going to be the people with the higher incomes that are probably going to want to source from us. And that really isn't true. It's like, we've got people of all kinds of income levels that source products, source their food from us and from other farms like us because they care. You know, it's like there's a certain subset of customers that go to local pastures because they deem it to be the most premium thing you can do. Right. Like, it'd be like having your boots made by this guy, Giancarlo, that like has a boot making cobbler shop on Second Street. And you shook his hand and he made your boots. And it's like, you don't really care. He's just like, you like that story and being able to. And then there's the people that like want the highest quality food, and they'll pay whatever needs to get paid because they realize it's like arguably the most important thing they spend their money on. Right. And those are the people that buy Giancarlo's boots because they're actually the most well-made boots and not because it's this status thing or whatever. You know, getting just the average Joe to start being mindful of like, hey, I got to quit eating this, like, you know, these freaking, you know, steroidal chickens, you know, the $5 Costco chicken or whatever. You know, think about what's going in those things. That's the challenge. And I think that's going to be slow. And I think that's going to require large scale agricultural producers to start opening their minds to the merits of regenerative farming techniques. And just, I think that if it happens, will be a slow transition. But I think someone like It's not RFK.
Yeah, RFK.
Being involved in government would be a really good thing for helping to push that forward. You know, I really do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do as well. I hope it happens faster.
Yeah.
One individual at a time, one family at a time, though. That's what it's going to take.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is happening. It's a complicated world, man.
It is. It is. Well, thank you for doing what you're doing.
Dude.
It's very important, and my family has benefited massively from it.
Good. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Taking the jump out of the city to the farm and building out Shirtail Creek and local pastures. It's we're very big fans and very happy customers.
So, thanks, man. Yeah. I appreciate that big time.
Yeah. We're, where can people find out more about what you guys are doing?
ShirtailCreekFarm.com. And then, and you obviously join our email list, and we send out an email once a week, just kind of talking about what's going on. And
follow them on Instagram if you want to see the chickens in their natural environment. It's
Shirtail Creek Farm on Instagram. And then, you know, stop by the local, if you're in Austin, stop by local pasture store and, you know, say hi to the crew over there. And, but yeah. And I mean, I all day long, I'm getting phone calls from customers with questions and stuff. That's what part of what I do. So, you know,
Well, Sam, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you do. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love.
Thank you.